I'm Adam Coleman, inviting you to the fifth season of The Cosmic Library from LitHub. This season, we go on our tiniest reading adventure yet, into short stories in the U.S. But this too turns out to be almost all-encompassing.
I think short stories are essentially brief encounters with felt life.
That's Oxford literary scholar Andrew Kahn, who gives us a deep history of the short story. And we hear from The New Yorker's Deborah Treisman, who explains her work as an editor of short fiction.
You know, if you are melding with another person, you don't turn that person into you, but you get to know the ins and outs of that person. So, and it's sort of like that. I always feel involved with the stories.
We bounce around between the history and current life of short stories with the novelist Justin Taylor.
The nice thing about it going out of fashion is that it really frees you up to relate to it in a different way.
This being the Cosmic Library, we make sure to go way beyond U.S. short stories, too. Here's the Washington Post critic, Becca Rothfeld.
A lot of Kafka short stories, I think, gesture at or describe sort of nightmarish geographies or architectures.
And the actor Max Gordon Moore reminds us just how wild short stories can be. With a reading in its entirety of Wakefield, the intensely strange, classic Nathaniel Hawthorne story.
He had contrived, or rather he had happened to dissever himself from the world, to vanish.
Get ready for all that and more in a season about short stories, small windows into vast universes. It's season 5 of The Cosmic Library, available soon wherever you go for podcasts.
Welcome to the Maris Review, brought to you by LitHub Radio.
I am so delighted to be here on the Maris Review with Ryan Chapman, who is my friend and was my colleague and is now the author of Riots I Have Known, a new novel out from Simon & Schuster. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. Hi, Maris.
Hi, Ryan. Ryan, there's a Jonathan Lethem blurb for your book, in which he compares you to Lenny Bruce meets Dostoevsky. And then on Amazon, the Amazon review issued by the company compares you to Proust and Knausgård. How do you respond?
Good question. I think that, you know, we know each other from both of us having worked in various guises in book publishing for years.
Yes.
And so you both know how many good writers there are out there.
Yes.
And then how many books you really like don't get the attention you feel like they deserve. And that meant that when I worked on a novel, I set my expectations very low. So it's been really difficult, to be honest, to take in good news because when there is a review like Amazon's or some of the others, my first thought is to read, to scan it quickly for like the word fraud or like this a-hole. And then when it doesn't have those words, I then go back and read it. And I honestly don't know how to take in good news. To be in the same breath with some of these people is like pretty amazing. And I don't know. I do think that like in a year when like the ego swelling has reached like maximum levels and like my wife has divorced me and friends don't want to talk to me and I have like a really expensive cigar habit that like ruins all my clothes, like then I'll have a good answer. But right now it's very it's a lot of feelings of gratefulness.
Good.
Yeah.
Do you want to just tell the audience the very basics about the plot of the book?
Sure. The book is written in the form of an editor's letter that is also confession by a prisoner who edits the prison newsletter. And the reason he is writing this book-length editor's letter is that he has accidentally set off a large-scale riot in the very correctional facility in which he is incarcerated. And he has barricaded himself in the computer lab and is live blogging.
Will and Edith Rosenberg. Media Center for Journalistic Excellence in the Penal Arts.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It rolls off the tongue.
Yes, it sure does.
And he is furiously confessing his life story, which he believes is one of great accomplishments and adventure, and is trying to write a very insincere mea culpa that He thinks that the riot isn't his fault, his many enemies coming to kill him are mistaken, and that history will remember him as the greatest prison newsletter editor of all time.
Newsletter editor?
Yeah.
Okay. Ryan, how the hell did you do this? You wrote a great satire.
Thank you.
Of so much of the just nitpicky garbage that we went through in publishing marketing meetings. How?
Well, like, spleen is a, like, great motivator for writing. and I think it's therapeutic for anyone who comes home and, like, looks at the liquor shelf. It's like, another way to process is create a, like, sociopathic narrator through whom you can process feelings and make jokes. A part of it came about that I think, like a lot of English majors and people who want to write, had that, you know, autobiographical earnest book.
Yes.
And mine was, I think it was like about a person who has a study abroad semester in France and Greece. And the way that it's best described is it was a like crap version of Leaving the Atocha Station. And like years later when I read that, I was like, oh, this is how a smarter person would write that book.
Sure.
And I had, I think when I was in my mid-20s, I had an editor friend whose taste I respected take a look at it, and he was very gentle and said, aww, like, you know, you can write, mm-hmm, you can't write this. Like, right. He was like, find your cause. Don't write just because you feel like, you know, putting sentences on the page is the end of it. Because I think from working in publishing, you know, we saw too often that there's the art side of it, which is kind of the reason that we all get excited about it.
Yeah.
And then there's the other side of it where you're like, it's not just that you're asking your friends to read it. You're hoping that strangers will like depart with their hard-earned money, mm-hmm, and like read your book over, you know, the best thing on Netflix that night or the great New Yorker piece that just came out.
Right.
Like that's the marketplace aspect. Mm-hmm. And when it came to the second book, I kind of had in mind, like, it'd be fun to write something that was hopefully funny to keep people engaged, short, so that I definitely don't have like a 500-page book in me.
But it's the densest, shortest book.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that I mean that as a compliment. Like, you have to pay attention line after line. There's joke, 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 joke. Plot.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know. I mean, there were certainly writers who I really admire who have that kind of density.
Yes.
And
want to name some of them?
Well, yeah, yeah. I think there were a few titles that I returned to a lot that were kind of like lodestars. One was certainly Martin Amis's Money. Mm-hmm. Second was, it definitely has like the worst title, but The Sugar Frosted Nutsack,
yep,
by Mark Lehner. And, I guess it would, two others. Thomas Bernhardt's The Loser. Mm-hmm. And the Czech writer Bohumil Hrabal, his book Too Loud a Solitude. You know, these were all books that, you know, had like maniacal storytelling, mm-hmm, at like the sentence level at their heart, and all of them have structures that are very innovative. But I think if you knew what you were getting into going in, you wouldn't want to like take the ride unless there was that voice that kind of hypnotized you.
I read this book, and I've been your friend for a long time now, and the voice of the main character, MF, is not someone I was familiar with at all.
Yeah, I had, like, a friend read it, and then there was, like, a long pause when he was like, I think you're a nice guy. And I was like, well, yeah, like, you know, like, I think it was great fun to work on. And then a lot of my interests as a reader and writer were in like very transgressive voices and material and satirical elements. And I think I knew that there might be a discrepancy between how I am in real life,
yeah,
and the book I was writing. And it just helped to like never think about it. Like, I honestly was like, well, when it's done, I'll think about it then. And then now that it's done, I kind of refuse to think about it. And I'm kind of like, I hope if like friends are really, Well, you'll be honest with me, but some other friends, I'm like, if they're like offended or insulted, I just hope they'll never tell me.
I imagine like there are former coworkers of yours thinking like, was he sitting in that meeting? Just
thankfully in publishing, as we learned from the Dan Mallory case, like people are too nice to ever call people on their bullshit. No, I mean, the other nice thing is to be serious about it, though, that the great benefit of having worked at places like Farfetch and Giroux and the Penguin Press is all my colleagues were so brilliant. And they would certainly understand the fictive distance between me and the satire.
Yes. I was saying to you earlier that I wanted to go through just a couple of cultural references in your book because it's, again, you say you want to write a short book, but there are so many. If I were to list them all, we'd be here for days. But here are a few of my favorites. There is a Kickstarter going to print and publish the Holding Pen blog in luxe leather-bound editions.
Of course. I mean, without getting too much into it, I did have an inside look through a friend, like a really smart, great friend, into Kickstarter's publishing efforts. And so that was a natural. I guess that's all we should say about that.
Sure.
Yeah.
I love, and you won't know this about me, but I love that the English language books discarded by American tourists in Sri Lanka include Nora Roberts, Patrick O'Brien, and Jack Welch.
Mm-hmm. The trifecta.
The trifecta of, I mean, the first two, kind of great.
Yeah.
The third, an evil, evil monster.
Yeah. I mean, Jack Welch, like... He's
dead. Sky.
Okay, good. but you know, he's still considered this like management leadership guru, and didn't he create the format of the businessman wants to boost his reputation by writing a trade memoir like How I Did It, and
so here's a funny fact about that. My very first job out of college, I was the assistant to a literary agent who represented him for that big, big memoir. At the time, it was the most money ever paid to an author for a nonfiction book.
Wow.
For U.S. rights. And it's like, of course, Jack Welch, the head of GE, he needed that money.
Yep.
Got
to buy another boathouse in I don't know, Thailand, I guess.
Yeah. And then the pub date for that book, the publication date, was 9/11/2001.
Oh.
And so the environment in the office was very much like, this thing is ruining this book launch that we're all so worried about.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is very cool.
Yeah, I think I like the idea of someone who like knew nothing about American culture.
Yeah.
Or was a non-traditional reader coming across someone like Jack Welch and then just misreading him entirely and being like, well, this is the template for how one, you know, gets ahead in life.
Certainly. And I mean, I don't think our politics today disprove that at all.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was talking with the writer Mark Doten last week.
Yeah.
And we were saying, you know, the difficult thing now about any type of writing satirically or writing about the culture is you have to like add an element of perversity and then extrapolate 2 years and then hope your book comes out within those 2 years so then it feels like the present.
I mean, and Mark wrote a book called Trump Sky Alpha.
Yeah, which is great.
It's great. It's so good. It's harrowing. I mean, first word in that novel title, you understand what you're getting into.
Yeah. Yeah.
That takes guts.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That book is so good.
The final reference that I wanted to get in here, because I love it, is MF, of course, says that when you're new to prison, there are a couple of things that you need.
Yeah, I know where this is going.
To help guide you through the life. And, of course, there is a BuzzFeed explainer, 17 tips, I think.
Mm-hmm. on like, what is it, how to protect your rep in prison or...
Yeah.
Yeah, how to get by. Like, that must exist. Like, that's something that... right. When I was writing it a few years ago, I was like, this is funny. And now it's like, of course that exists.
Somewhere.
Yeah. The it can be... I think one of the joys of writing the book was certainly in coming up with the concept pretty early on. And it was just from partially working in publishing and on the one hand being exposed to so many great novels just as part of your job. But at the same time, you know, you'd wake up at like 2 a.m. with like that light bulb going off and then think like, well, that's the next project. And then you go to work a couple of days later and then the launch meeting would be someone doing a much better job of that same idea. And so part of the concept came about of just what's like the idea, the voice, the setting and the approach that like no one else could possibly do in the time it takes me to write this. And since I was writing it while maintaining it 9 to 5, it had to go slowly. So yeah, once I had kind of chanced upon that concept, it was like really great to look at the culture and see which parts kind of fell into that. And,
right.
You know, BuzzFeed is low hanging fruit for satire,
yes.
You know, done with affection, but.
Yes, anyone who's watched Veep this season knows that.
Oh, I just finished it. Oh man.
Let's not spoil
yeah.
anything.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I have feelings. And so the other thing that is you but not you is that your main character is Sri Lankan.
Yeah, yeah.
And at one point he says Sri Lanka is the youngest ancient country on Earth.
Yeah.
Tell me what that means. Because well, I feel like that's coming from you and not him.
Yeah, it very much is. My father and his family grew up in Sri Lanka and they came to the States in the 70s and that's always been certainly a part of our lives, but really not a large part until we were kind of adults and took more frequent trips back to the island. And Sri Lanka is such a unique nation and not too dissimilar from the United States in certain ways in that there's a lot of religious and ethnic plurality. Mm-hmm. Recently, you know, the Easter attacks have shown how it is a country that worked extraordinarily hard to heal after its civil war ended in 2009. And unfortunately, those that riven population is still at odds, to put it inarticulately and mildly. But I think by virtue of the fact that Sri Lanka had been colonialized by several different European
yes.
powers, had not only been something of a toddler when it came to post-colonial independence, mm-hmm. They achieved independence the same time as India, but because of the changes in power and the lack of any kind of homogeneous religious, ethnic, or even like cultural group, it's just like a fascinating country. And I kept approaching it as I got older, wondering why it didn't have kind of a unified arts scene or a unified industrial sector the way that a lot of other countries of the same size mm-hmm. have. But this fascinating, amazing place. And you know, the recent violence aside, it is a island that we went to several times in the past 20 years and had great time, you know, and even, you know, there was a point where my wife and I considered like, let's go back there yes. for like 6 months and just try and like, you know, see more of the family.
I just want to break in here and say, mm-hmm. yeah, I've already asked you about this, but mm-hmm. for the listeners, none of your family was affected by the Easter attacks.
Yeah, we're really, really lucky. The Easter attacks occurred in several of the sites that my family would have been in on Easter or been places that we regularly visit when we go there or my dad visits. And so we were quite shaken by it. And thankfully, everybody's okay.
Ugh.
Yeah. And Sri Lanka was also really fascinating from a literary perspective, because it is a country that growing up, the only cultural export we had was Michael Ondaatje, who's incredible. His most famous book was one of his least Sri Lankan narratives, Patient. And he's lived in Toronto for a number of decades. And now it's nice because I think that there's a lot of young Sri Lankan writers coming up and older Sri Lankan writers.
Can you name a couple?
Well, I mean...
Not just name.
Sure. I mean...
Just name a few if you really know.
Yeah. Sunil Yapa is Sinhalese American as well. And his book, Your Heart is a Muscle the Size of a Fist,
that's great,
was published a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. Rue Freeman is another really talented Sri Lankan writer. There was an anthology of emerging Sri Lankan writing that was put out by Penguin UK that hasn't been published in the US that I picked up in Colombo a couple years ago. And I can see the cover in my mind, but I cannot think of it.
We can look it up for show notes.
It'll be in the show notes.
Yes.
And it ended up being this great compendium, a much needed compendium of here are all the people who are working. And there's a large diaspora culture. So there's a lot of Sri Lankan writers living in the UK and Australia and India and Canada. It's great because it is a country that can support dozens and dozens of different lenses.
I love that. Let's talk about prison for a moment. How did you get inside the idea of being in this prison?
I know. Good question.
Was it all TV?
No. That happened kind of backwards, where my roommate in when I started the book, and I was talking about my roommate, he was in Juilliard for playwriting, and then he went off to go work on Orange is the New Black. And there was a small subplot in season 2 or 3 where Piper works on the prison newsletter. And Nick, you stole my idea. But he didn't steal it. It was given. It was in the universe. The idea came about as I was a straight male living in Park Slope and Gowanus, Brooklyn, and I knew the world didn't need more books about that experience or that setting. Mm-hmm. And when I thought about writing something that would be more voice driven and be more transgressive, and certainly my hope was that something that would be hopefully a book that was like 5 or 10% beyond my talent level when I started, and then just through hitting my head against the wall, going down wrong avenues after a few years, I figure it out. And so writing something that I didn't have the direct autobiographical experience with, but was an environment that was very fascinating and one that readers didn't come across very often, kind of pointed towards the prison. And then I also liked it. It was really, I knew that there would be there already has been great writing on prisons and a lot of it in by journalists and formerly incarcerated people. But I think for my approach, I wanted the satirical pitch to be just a few percent off reality. And so I thought, I didn't want anyone coming to it thinking they were getting
real life.
Yeah, exactly.
But you do kind of get into the privatization of prisons in a way that, I wouldn't want to call it fun.
Right. And that was part of the challenge is, it can be Veep kind of talks about this too a little bit, is how dark can you make your comedy given your subject matter? Mm-hmm. And it was fun to explore that. And it was a challenge to see, like, how close can you go towards something maybe being over the line and then kind of like coming back a little bit.
Yeah.
But it's, that's one of the great things about fiction and I think the first person voice is, unlike a film or a painting or music, like people will kind of go with you into like incredibly transgressive and yeah. dark places, and then the laugh at things that they would never laugh at, like if they were told at, you know, the same story at a dinner table.
Sure.
That's the hope, at least.
Are there any other books that strike you that way you want to mention? No pressure either.
Like, yeah. Well, you know, it's been a long time since I read it, but I definitely had that teenage reading of Trainspotting.
Oh, yeah. I get that.
And, like, you know, the movie's also great, but the book is, like, long. And it mm-hmm. is, like, it is full of degradation.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it gets so terrible that the Irvin Welsh just kind of demands that you laugh at it because there's no other way to look that directly at that material without throwing it across the room. Trainspotting. What else? That's a good question. I guess going back to Mark Lehner, you know, he routinely writes. I really admire how he can kind of fold in a lot of the culture and do so with this agreement with the reader that we're going to kind of be indiscriminate in what we're talking about. And it's all going to be done in the service of this literary project. And so he'll fold in a lot of sacred cows. He can pull it off by virtue of the work he's put in and his talent.
Yeah.
And so, again, that novel, The Sugar Frosted Nutsack, if there were like a Pulitzer for comedy, he would have won. And it has a title that's tough for a lot of people, but it is just pure brilliance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe we should end this episode by talking about what you're listening to, because I know that's very important to you.
Music. Sure. Oh man, I feel like I've become an old man in the last like mm-hmm. year or two. I never know like good new stuff.
It doesn't have to be new.
Okay, good. I mean, I do like Billie Eilish, and like that was like definitely a recent musician that I was excited that was like extremely popular that I also liked. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, this is like dark stuff. Like the teenagers are getting into their Trent Reznor phase.
We get what the teenagers are doing. Yeah.
Lately I've been like re-listening to Magnetic Field 69 Love Songs because that's so good.
It's so good.
Wow. I don't know. What have you been listening to?
I have a Spotify playlist called Songs I Downloaded from MP3 Blogs mm-hmm. in the Early Aughts.
Oh, I need this playlist.
So yeah, I will put it in the show notes too.
Mm-hmm.
it's really taken me back to 2004.
Yeah, that was like a magical time.
It really was.
That's the tough thing is I have to accept that stretch. Were like, I still listen to the Future Heads, the Strokes, and the Rakes were this like British band.
Oh, yeah, I remember the Rakes.
Yeah, they're still good. I mean, I think they broke up, and I think the singer now does IT, but they had some bangers.
Sure did.
Yeah.
Ryan, yeah. Thank you for coming on the Maris Review.
Thank you for having me, Maris. This was great.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to the Maris Review, and check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.